Linda Hicks, a member of our parish who attends the 5 o'clock Saturday Mass, recently got back from her long-anticipated trip to Egypt. She'd been wanting to go for a long time, and she had a great time learning all about the history of the pyramids and all the ancient Egyptian history of the kings. But she also learned a lot about contemporary Islam in Egypt, which you just breathe in there. It permeates everything. And she told me about the reverent feeling that came over her every morning, awakening with the call to prayer every dawn. And it was interesting for her, she said, to compare Islam and Catholicism. One of the things that her local guide talked about a lot was how Islam, in his words, makes it pretty easy to feel sure that you're going to heaven. This is not something that you have to really worry about too much, as some of us might have felt we had to in the churches that we grew up in. There aren't many special prayers that you have to say a certain set number of times or on certain days. There's no intricate rules that you really have to follow to the letter. There's no catechism to memorize. There aren't a lot of special devotions that you have to do. There are just a handful of simple practices, what Islam calls the five pillars: prayer, fasting, almsgiving, pilgrimage, and reverence to God. And if you make some attempt at those, then you're doing just fine. Moreover, Linda's guide said, in the Islam that he had grown up with anyway, you had the sense that the pillars aren't all weighted the same in the cosmic scheme of things. Almsgiving, helping those in need, is far and away the most important. And he added that generally there's a bending over backwards to interpret that in such a way that everybody gets some points. So if you've been going through a misanthropic period in your life, if you're looking back at this last week with the holiday, or back over the last few months or a few years, and think to yourself, you know, I have not always been the shining example of a human being that maybe I should have been. So maybe I failed the test, maybe I'm hopeless. There's the belief here that there's no need to give up on yourself. And for certain, God hasn't given up on you. Because in the kind of inventory that God makes of a person's life, God is not like that grumpy relative that probably all of us have somewhere in the picture who seems to be scrutinizing every little thing, just looking for a fault, just looking for something to criticize. God looks around at our life, and when all we can see is our failings, our unkindnesses, the times we fell short when maybe we could have done something heroic, God looks around and sees, for instance, that we own a pet and praises us for nurturing a fellow living creature, praises our charitableness, our almsgiving, for feeding and sheltering a life. And I can see some of you calculating now and saying, okay, but I don't own a pet. Well, you're in luck, because if you have a house plant, you also get some points in this category, because you're helping creation to flourish. You're tending life. You're providing water and light, an unselfish act. It's very freeing, Linda noted, to walk around with this view of life, that God really is not waiting to be disappointed in us, but already finds us good. We've already done more than we imagine, probably, to please God's heart. And I wonder if we can really take that in. Jesus' parable of the sheep and the goats carries that same message for us in a Christian context that Linda's Muslim tour guide was talking about to her. The test of whether we're doing good in the great scheme of things isn't about beliefs or creeds. It's not even about mighty deeds of heroism. The measure of our lives is, have we done good in the small, everyday interactions? It's the little things, the daily choices, that can turn this world into heaven or hell. We often overlook the good we've done, like the people in the gospel. We say, I haven't done anything. I haven't really made a big contribution to tilt the balance of the world in favor of goodness. But look at these actions that Jesus mentions and that he says minister not just to other people, but actually to God. For I was hungry and you gave me food, thirsty and you gave me something to drink. Raise your hand if you've given a card to the Adopt-A-Family program for Thanksgiving or Christmas. Raise your hand if you've cooked a meal, either for somebody in the parish or for our friends at the Holiday Inn, or if you've given food to our monthly food collection for the outreaches. Naked and you gave me clothing. Raise your hand if you've donated to Lydia's clothing cupboard over at the Fitzhugh Street building so our asylum seeker friends could browse coats and socks and other things they need. Raise your hand if you've donated items on the wish list for one of our outreaches. In prison and you visited me, raise your hand if you are connected in any way to Spiritus Christi prison outreach. Sick and you visited me, raise your hand if you visited a sick relative or a friend. A stranger and you welcomed me, so greeters, raise your hand. Raise your hand if you've said hello to anybody that you don't know that well in church this morning. And raise your hand if you will do that. There is still time. Now all of our hands should be up, right? So congratulations. We have all just measured up to Jesus' one and only test. It's not hard. Yesterday I was talking to a woman who was telling me about a recent visit she had with her great-niece and great-nephew. They're not church people, that was the first thing she told me, a little apologetically at first. She said, I mean, they were raised Catholic, but now they're atheists. And I'm not sure if she thought that would worry me. I think it worried her a little bit. Midway through the conversation, she kind of pivoted, and she said, did you know that around me where I live, all the grocery stores, all these Tops, Trader Joe's, all of them, sometimes those big fridges with all the food, sometimes they fail with a power outage or something. And did you know that when that happens, they can't keep the food that was in them? It has to be thrown away. It's a regulation. I said, no, I didn't know that. Oh, what a terrible waste. And she brightened. She said, yes, it would be, except for my great niece and nephew. And now her voice was so proud. What they do, she said, is they go around and they leave their phone number with all the local grocery stores. And they tell the staff that if this ever happens, if the fridges fail, please call them. And they will come and pick up the food, all those pounds and pounds and pounds of food. And they'll deliver it to the shelters and the food pantries and other places that need it. They bought a big freezer with their own money, she told me. She added, like a restaurant-sized freezer. And they put that in the basement at their house so that they could store all the rescued food when this happens until it can be handed out. And when there's more than they can fit in their car and the big freezer in the basement, then they call up all their friends and they say, at this time, we're going to leave this big stack of grocery bags full of food on our front porch. This is our address. Send over anybody in your life you can think of who could use having a little extra food in their cupboard, tell them they can help themselves until it's gone. They're not Christians, she added. They're not people of faith. I don't know. Many people who would say they don't have much connection to Jesus are far closer to him than they think and understand him much better than they believe they do. Amen. Today's feast of Christ the King was relatively late as an addition by the church into the calendar of the liturgical year. It was a 20th century feast. It was created at a time when fascism was on the rise, created to counter the rhetoric of authoritarian leaders who were claiming a right to people's ultimate allegiance and themselves trying to divide up the world according to their own standards, labeling some people as good and fully human, and other people as damnable and less than human. Against this, the church created the Feast of Christ the King to remind us that God is the only one who gets to take the measure of people. And God finds goodness and humanity in people of every culture, every faith, and none at all, every temperament, and life circumstance. And Jesus tells us today in these really stark terms that how we treat others truly is how we treat him. So when we see someone excluded or suffering or deprived of the basic things they need to live, we should hear Jesus' voice saying, "This is my body." There's no separation between Christ and the people we encounter every day, especially the poor. Many of you know of Peter Morin, the founder of the Catholic Worker Movement and a mentor to Dorothy Day. He dedicated himself to a life of radical, voluntary simplicity and living alongside the people he ministered with, not above, with the very hardest hit people in the city. One day, a wealthy ladies' charitable society in Westchester County invited Morin to be the distinguished keynote speaker at a lunch they were having. He agreed, said he would come up on the train from where he was based in New York City at the time. At the hour that his train was due to arrive, the ladies from the charitable society sent one of their members to pick him up at the station. She waited and waited, 10 minutes, 15 minutes, then an hour went by. Other passengers all disembarked and went on their way. But scanning the crowd, she just couldn't see anyone who could possibly be Peter Morin. Eventually, she called up Dorothy Day at the Catholic Worker House in New York to ask if there had been some mix-up, had his train been canceled. And Dorothy Day, you could hear the puzzlement in her voice. She said, "No, the train left on time this morning, and he always keeps his appointments, and he's never late." Hesitantly, she asked the woman from the Charitable Society, "You're absolutely sure he isn't there?" The woman scanned the station again. By now, it was almost empty. There was nobody left but a homeless man who she assumed lived at the station, sleeping there in one of the benches off in the corner. Dorothy Day, hearing this, said, "Can you describe the homeless man?" The woman frowned in disbelief and gave what seemed like a pretty generic description. She said, "Well, he's wearing tattered clothes, his coat's full of holes, he's got a hat that's kind of falling apart." Peals of laughter came back over the phone. "That's Peter," Dorothy Day said. "Absolute certainty. That's him. He's probably been waiting for you since his train came in hours ago and just decided to take a nap while he waited." Jesus was not only a servant of the poor, he was a poor man himself. And today, too, he comes to us in that form, blending in as one without shelter, without fancy clothes. He is the distinguished guest and teacher that we often miss because he comes to us in a surprising appearance. At the end of our days, what will matter most isn't how big a house we have or how many things we have, what accolades we've earned, how many times our name's been in the newspaper. And our religion won't be measured by how many prayers we've said or what rules we've memorized or what specific creeds we sign on to. What matters in the end are the times we took care of each other, and especially the most vulnerable. The Dalai Lama put it in a beautiful way, echoing the spirit of today's gospel. He said, "My religion is simple. My religion is kindness.